ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। वी आर रीडिंग फ्रॉम श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 7 चैप्टर 15 एंटाइटल्ड इंस्ट्रक्शंस फॉर सिविलाइज्ड ह्यूमन बीइंग्स verses 7 through 9 nadadyadamisham shade nachadya dharma tatvavit मुन्यनै स्यात् परा पृथ्वी यथा न पशु हिंसया। अ पर्सन फुली अवेयर ऑफ रिलीजियस प्रिंसिपल्स शुड नेवर ऑफर एनीथिंग लाइक मीट, फिश और एग्स इन द श्राद्ध सेरेमनी, एंड इवन इफ वन इज अ क्षत्रिय ही हिमसेल्फ शुड नॉट ईट सच थिंग्स। व्हेन सूटेबल फूड प्रिपेयर्ड विद घी इज ऑफर्ड टू सेंटली पर्सन्स, the function is pleasing to the forefathers and the supreme lord, who are never pleased when animals are killed in the name of sacrifice. Text 8, translation: persons who want to advance in superior religion are advised to give up all envy of other living entities, whether in relationship to the body, words or mind. There is no religion superior to this. No purport again. So text 9, translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Because of an awakening of spiritual knowledge, those who are intelligent in regard to service, who are actually aware of religious principles and who are free from material desires, control the self in the fire of spiritual knowledge or knowledge of the absolute truth. They may give up the process of ritualistic ceremonies. Purport: people are generally very much interested in karmakand ritualistic ceremonies for elevation to the higher planetary systems. But when one awakens his spiritual knowledge, he becomes uninterested in such elevation and engages himself fully in gnan yagya to find the objective of life. The objective of life is to stop completely the miseries of birth and death, and to return home back to Godhead. When one cultivates knowledge for this purpose, he is considered to be on a higher platform than one who is engaged in karma yagya or fruitive activities. Hare Krishna. So, yesterday we heard about, for those who were present here, the entire class was on the benefits of prasad. So I will just take the second part which Prabhupada said in Canto 8 regarding envy. And as he said, there is no superior religion than to come out of the envious nature. So this is very relevant to every living creature. The difference is that a sincere devotee is aware of this weakness and is always cautious. It is not that you take to spiritual life means you it evaporates completely. In fact, this is actually the root of the problems, because eventually we are in this material world because of envy of Krishna. So for most people, not seeing Krishna or not even having difficulty in believing the concept of Krishna or God makes it very convenient to feel that this phrase, you know, envious of Krishna, has no meaning. Because how do you envy someone whom you don't even, first of all, agree that he exists? Or if he exists in an impersonal form. So it's very convenient to feel that there is no question of any envy. So it is only for the personalist, for those who are really seeking to be the servants of the Lord, who would be very concerned with understanding what envy of Krishna would really ultimately mean in so many forms. And ultimately, we are told that very simply that envy of Krishna means that any enjoyment which is separate from Krishna, any existence which is in the absence of the present, any absence of trace of Krishna. So, which means this governs all our activities, everything that we do, and everything that we will do in future. This definition will always be applicable. So, if you see the traces of people who live without the presence of Krishna, typically there would be, you know, the a very strong belief in their own capacity, you know, wanting to succeed, and particularly if we are already successful, if we have been given some attributes of success, of intelligence, beauty, wisdom, wealth, strength, then it becomes even more difficult to believe that we are incapable. The immediate feeling is that our own self-evaluation is based on our capability, and that is what we have been brought up right through, right from childhood. You know, when if we come 15th in a class of 25 in school, you know, we are told that there's something wrong and we are pressurized to do much more. So it starts in so many different ways, you know, in sports also. I remember when I was the captain of my school in cricket, and then, and I'll never forget this because it's so painful, you know. At, you know, the Kennedy Sea Face, you know, 5,000 people were watching. It was an inter-school final of the, and we had won the previous year. And we had a very strong coach, you know, he used all kinds of language. He was a father, a padri, Father Neto. So we used to be very fearful of him. And I was opening batsman, so I went and I just made two runs. So the next innings, he demoted me and I went number 10. And, you know, imagine for a captain to be told by the, you know, he was the principal and the coach. So these things become very vivid. So we are always trained to feel that, you know, your evaluation is based on your capacity. If you don't do well, if you don't reach certain goals, certain marks, levels, then you are actually deficient. And then this goes right through. You pass college and you start working, and we all know what it is like, that we evaluated now even more so in how we perform. Even when we are at home, it is the same, that you know, there is very competitive spirit to do better, faster. And it comes in so many ways, where it means that if there are new gadgets, then if you don't know how to use the gadgets, means you are deficient. That means it subtly implies that knowledge is based on grasping technology. And if you know technology, which means you are advancing substantially. So it is not the use of technology which is the problem, but the consciousness. Everywhere it is. So it's not that we should come last because we want to be humble or we don't want to be envious. Or it's not like we should do our best. But the problem is that we have been taught to feel inferior, and there is no bones. You know, there is no kind of. No shame in even our parents and our relatives and or everybody telling us clearly where we stand if we don't do well. So this is the kind of background in which we are trained. And therefore, when we come to Krishna consciousness and we hear that we have to be humbler than the blade of grass, so more tolerant than a tree, and we should not be envious of others, we should, you know, we like the concept, but then we perhaps don't kind of relate it to many of the things that we may be actually unconsciously doing, or even consciously perhaps, but feeling that it is of a minor nature. Because everything in Krishna consciousness becomes more subtle. So the problems also become more subtle, generally speaking, because that is one area where the devotee clearly, you know, even a struggling devotee, clearly scores over a non-devotee, that he immediately confronts the gross problems and is in most cases able to overcome that, which means it's a major plus, because without that it is a non-starter really to our struggle in Krishna consciousness. But having done that, we may miss out on the subtler aspects. If we take the mentality of Kalia in the story of Krishna and Kalia, when Krishna was playing with his childhood, his friends, cowherd friends. So the mentality was that, you know, he had so much strength because of his in the snake world, you know, the ability to emit poison is considered to be supreme test, and you know, any bird that flew over also could die. So obviously he was numero uno in the field of snakes. He was absolutely the number one. Anybody who dived into the waters also became unconscious. So he was so powerful. But his mentality was that he did not want anyone to even touch the waters. So this is also again a trait which we see, that when we acquire something, when we have some strength, we want to possess it, control it, and we do not want anyone to not only touch it or to come near it. And you will see this not only on an individual level, but if you see that even on a family level or even on a community or a national level, for instance, you know, there is so much of national pride that is brought in, which what does it do? When we talk of a national pride, we talk of a geography which is said that, you know, we belong to this, and therefore anybody who whatever is good for that geography is good. So gradually morality also may lose its value unless it's backed up by spiritual values. If it's combined with spiritual values, then of course you do best for your own country. But today, when we see that in the name of national pride, you could kill others, you could acquire other countries, you may not invade like in the past, which was much more common, but more subtle ways of going through, you know, installing your own puppet regime, and so many ways which you control the levers of power. So these come from the same mentality that if you see, what is the common factor? The common factor is that what is good for our own self, our own sense gratification, whether it's on a personal level, family level, community level, or national level, is justified. And when we have this strong mentality, then any means would be justified. And anything that is threatening that, if we feel that maybe our country may run out of oil, or somebody is going to threaten our national security. National security is a word which is very loosely used, that under name of national security you could torture other people, you could put them in prison. This is what is happening, and this is actually admitted. Virtually every country indulges in it, and in such gruesome ways. So this is the same trait we see that pervades right through life and through everyone. So this is the kind of background in which every person who comes to Krishna consciousness starts off with. Now when we come to our own lives, then when we see that this mentality, if it is not recognized, that even in devotee lives, it may start working in different ways. So why do we say that, what do we do to really please Krishna? Because ultimately our goal of life is to please Krishna. It is not necessary, we are not there to excel in a particular field. Even as a devotee, it is not that we are there to be the best mridang player or best cook or best book distributor or best fund collector. Ultimately, that is a stepping stone to please Krishna. So that's where the relationships matter, and how we treat others and how we think, our consciousness will affect others. So there's a very nice example which has been given of the magnet, where, as you know, all a magnet has a positive pole and a negative pole. So we are taught that the positive and the negative attract each other. The positive repulses the positive, while the positive the negative attracts the positive. So in this example, we are told that actually Krishna is the supreme most positive, is the real. And therefore, what would attract him most is, if we take by taking a very humble position, to the degree that we feel that we are nothing, that I am nothing, and we genuinely feel that we are actually the lowest, which means that is in the negative domain. To that extent, the positive is attracted by the negative. So that's what really attracts Krishna. And to the extent that we think that, you know, we want to do something, we can do this, we can... it's like the ascending process, that we are wanting to acquire on our own capacity, strength, knowledge, and I will do this myself. I am the master and I have the key of success. To that extent, we are thinking ourselves positive, and positive repulses positive. So in fact, Krishna would further go away. So this is the understanding that which also tells us from the scriptures that the position that we can only understand, try to understand Krishna when we start off in a very the more we understand how little we know, the more the easier it will be for us to come closer to Krishna. And there are two services which Maya is always she cannot defeat. One is Harinam, and the second is the service to Vaishnavas. And therefore, Maya will do everything to see that we are off these two tracks, how we can fall off. That's why, to the extent that we have the mentality to lord it over, you know, to become the controller, or to feel that we are the doers, to that extent it becomes easier for her to derail us. So, if you see what is our response, what would be the response of a devotee to this mentality of envy, then that's very nicely given in the story of Maharaj Prithu in the Srimad Bhagavatam, where Maharaj Prithu was like other great emperors, actually is an avatar of the Lord. When he was ruling the world, he was the entire world, every populace was very very happy. There was bountiful crops, people were really very kind to each other, they really worshipped the king because he was very vigilant, like we have seen in Amrish Maharaj, Parikshit Maharaj, Lord Ramchandra, who the great emperors who actually were concerned about every single person. So Maharaj Prithu was in the same mold. And to please Krishna, he had performed Ashwamedh Yajnas. And he had done, each Ashwamedh Yajna, first of all, is such a, it's an awesome task. Ashwamedh Yajna, which was done in those eras, those yugas, was actually where, first of all, it needed thousands of people, many, many years, to prepare everything for the satisfaction of performing the yajna. And then there was a sacrificial horse which had to go to all the various countries all over the world as a symbol of asking the other kings to accept the strength of this emperor. So either they would accept it willingly or they would oppose it, in which case there would be a war, and then that would decide who would be the winner. So to do one yajna, apart from all the thousands of people, Brahmins who would be performing, who would be preparing everything for the satisfaction, this to conquer the entire world, in most cases it would be willingly accepted, because not only it was just physical strength, it was also the acceptance of the kings of that this, like in case of Maharaj Prithu, that he was perfectly justified in doing it and he was worthy of receiving it. So most would agree. In a few cases, then they would enter war and they would lose that. So completing all of that, and then the yajna would be done. So like that, he had done 99 yajnas. So he had, and he was now about to do the 100th Ashwamedh yajna, which would have really made him the supreme most. And Indra is a very powerful and a demigod, is also a great devotee. But he had already done Ashwamedh yagyas. He had done 100 of them. And he did not want Maharaj Prithu to do the 100th yagya. And this is, we can see that this mentality or this feeling is also something which we all carry even as devotees. Now, Indra was actually, is a devotee, so one would say, how come this could happen to a devotee? But he is we are told is a karma misha bhakta, which means the bhakti is tinged with desire, material desires. This traces of envy would also remain. So that means as devotees it would coexist. And if we are neophyte level, then the traces would be of bhakti with lots of envy. So the proportions may change. So if we put it in various activities in our life, and then analyze, so the question really comes to us is, what is our consciousness in which we do various activities? We take the case of, if we are collecting funds, is it that we are wanting to be doing it for getting the recognition that we are the best collector? Is it that we are, if we're making garlands, is it for getting recognition that we are the best? And in this connection, Maharaj, Radhanath Maharaj, had given a wonderful class, which he said that, he asked the question, he said, this is one question devotee should always ask. That, for instance, he gave the example of the garland, that when we are making a garland, are we decorating the deities, or are we decorating our false ego? And he also said that, how do we know then, what is the answer? He said, if you are making garlands, and if you don't know how to make garlands, then you're very happy if someone is making wonderful garlands, because it doesn't matter. But if you're doing very well, and if someone else is praised, you have already heard praises, and then someone else is praised, then you are not very happy hearing someone else who's very doing very well, in which you also excel, then that detracts your happiness. Definitely, then that is a tinge of envy in that. And then perhaps we may try to see that we get the best flowers and we may do it for our own self. And the same activity could be, he said, if you're doing cooking for the Lord, or even at home, calling devotees, and you're a very wonderful cook. Everybody says you make the best dishes, and then if you don't know cooking, then you can hear everybody's glories. But if you know cooking and you're already praised, and then someone else is given that praise in your presence, saying that he's a wonderful cook, then somehow you may feel threatened. And then if you are asked a recipe by that person, then you will give a very general answer, it's like this, like this, like this. But you keep the key parts, away. Same with playing mridangas. So if you're playing wonderful mridangas, then someone asks you, and if you see him as a competitor, someone who else who's doing very well, then you may perhaps not teach him the key notes, the couple of things which you'll hold back. So you want some exclusivity, you want to retain that. This would happen in every sphere, even in our, when supposing we are respecting other devotees. Someone is our mentor, our guru, and then we find that someone else is coming closer. And you may have had some recognition, maybe in our congregation, say it was a much smaller congregation. And then now, for the preaching purposes, our mentors, our guru, the senior Vaishnavas who were spending time with us, they were spending time elsewhere. And if it takes away a little bit of a happiness, that why is the attention being divided? I'm being missed out. I'm feeling like the victim. These are all traces of the feeling. We need to guard against that. So actually, that's something which is so subtle that we constantly need to question. So what Maharaj had said, that this is the question we need to ask, that if we are feeding the devotees or feeding the Lord, are we feeding the Lord or are we feeding our false ego? Are we glorifying, say, giving class, for instance? Are we are supposed to be glorifying, but if we find that our motive, perhaps maybe, that we know we are a good, we can give a good class or communicate well, But then if someone else is a very good communicator and he gets praise, then in which case this would come out if we feel definitely not so happy. So again, whether we are glorifying the Lord or glorifying our false ego. So our false ego is actually it is just around the corner, just behind our shoulder. So the minute we are slightly, our consciousness wavers, it can step in straight off. Then, so Prabhupada has said, coming back to Maharaj Prithu's story, so this was what Indra was feeling. Then, when he heard that the sacrifice was about to be performed, the 100th one, so he disguised himself as a sadhu, came to there, and he came and stole the sacrificial horse. Because without the sacrificial horse, the yagya is a non-starter. And he disappeared. So the son of Maharaj Prithu went after him, and he eventually discovered the horse. So when he saw that this person is with the horse, so obviously he knew that this is the person who stole the horse. So he had his bow and arrows, but he was so well trained by his father. This was the culture at that time. The Vedic culture was such that when they saw a sadhu, the sadhu was higher than the king. The worship and the respect to the sadhu was higher than the king. In fact, we know that how kings and emperors would actually bathe the feet of the sadhus, make them sit on the throne. So that is the real Vedic culture. So the same way the son was seeing that. So when he saw the sadhu, though he knew that he is the one who's taken the horse, so he put down his bow and arrows to offer his obeisances. And then he took the horse and came back. And then Atri Muni was with Swami. He said that actually you are making a mistake, because he's a fraud. He's not a real sadhu. He's a thief. You should kill him. So then he picked up his bow and arrows, but by that time Indra had gone. So he brought the horse back, and then all the preparations started. And again the Ashwamedh Yagya had to be performed. So you can imagine how many years would have gone by. Every time you want to prepare, means you have to again ascertain your supremacy and get that recognition from all over the world. So it's a long process going on over several years. Everything got ready. And then again, Indra comes in disguise of another type of sadhu. So, again, the same thing. And he completely covers everything with darkness at the appropriate moment. So that in that darkness, he steals the horse. And again, Prithu Maharaj's son goes after, finds the horse eventually. And then, his culture is so strong that again he puts down his bow and arrow and pays obeisances. And then he brings the horse back, and again, Atri Muni chastises him and tells him that this is not correct. You have to, you should pick up and fight him. So you should kill him, in fact. So again, he picks up his bow and arrows, but Indra has made his, he's a mystic yogi, so he just disappeared. So this went on. This again, the third time he did it, the fourth time he did it. It went on for such a long time that, in fact, in Bhagavatam it is said that every time that Indra was actually disguising himself like this and perpetuating a kind of fraud, taking a false sadhu's role, in fact, he started a disciplic succession which is going on today. So it said that actually there is no shortage of fraudulent sadhus or people who pose. So in fact, they all are coming from a lineage going up to, so the start was at that time. And he had done so many that each one started lineage, and then it has expanded substantially. So it's given in the Bhagavatam. So eventually all the sages who were assembled there, there were thousands of sages all over the world, they come, and then they were very perturbed by this, upset. So they went to Maharaj Prithu and said that this can't go on. You have to do something about it. So Maharaj Prithu could see that his son could not do the job. So he picked up the bow and arrows himself, and he said, I will go and kill Indra. And he went after Indra, and he would have done it. But the Brahmins who were all assembled there, they said that, no, actually, you should not do it, because you have to sit in the sacrifice yourself. You know, you are the main person, so you should not be doing it. So let we will perform a fire sacrifice, and you will handle the job. Don't worry. Actually, the Brahmins had such power that they could easily do it, and this was true at all times. But they would not exercise it. Even in Lord Ram's Ramchandra's times, it was when Vishwamitra Muni who asked the two young boys to come and kill the demons. It was not that they could have easily done it, but their business at that time, the process of yajna was so important that they did not want to spoil it, and they wanted a kshatriya to handle that. So they had the power, but they restrained. So here also, but here they saw that actually Maharaj Prithu was so key, and he should not be doing it. So they said, we will do it. So they prepared a big fire, and they invoked many mantras, and these mantras would bring Indra from wherever he was hiding, and would perish in the fire. Such was their power. So they started everything, and they were about to start. they were about to actually start the fire to bring Indra out of hiding. And then at that moment, Lord Brahma comes. And Lord Brahma is the chief of all the demigods. So then he comes and he tells Maharaj Prithu that you should stop, don't do this. Because your purpose is to satisfy Vishnu, and definitely Vishnu will not be happy if you kill Indra. So, better that you don't do this 100th yajna. Just hearing that, imagine the pinnacle of material success beyond imagination. We cannot even imagine what it means to what Maharaj Prithu was on the brink of. And having spent thousands of years coming to the culmination of the 100th yajna, and just the minute he heard Lord Brahma say that, he said, forget it. So the interest of harmony and peace of the whole world, and more important, following the instructions of a sadhu, of a great respected person like Lord Brahma, was supreme in his mind. He said, satisfying Vishnu meant giving that up, then I would do so. So we see this is the pinnacle of the ideal example of how a devotee should respond to when we are when we are stretched on two views. We also hear from our own ISKCON sadhus, and you are aware of how the ISKCON is governed by. The whole ISKCON society is governed by the governing body of commissioners, GBC. There are something like 30-odd GBCs. These are the senior most and most learned and respected members of the society of ISKCON, Krishna Consciousness, spread all over the world. And all of them have put in at least 35 years or more in Krishna Consciousness. So they are really the core of the whole movement. And when they get together for 2 weeks in a year, often we have heard from that when they here we are seeing the very pure devotees who are very together in a very wonderful mood, but with that comes very strong personalities, that they have strong views, and they have and this is not only about spiritual principles. Often it goes, most of the time it is down to policies and individual decisions to in certain events and what to do with it. So when you have so many people, you're bound to have 5, 7, 10 different views on many and various subjects. So this cooperation, which is really where we saw how Maharaj Prithu surrendered to the higher principle of pleasing the Lord. This cooperation also we hear of in GBC meetings. We have heard how they then eventually we have two views or more views. Then you are convinced of that it is the right view. But if it is not harming major spiritual principles, then the best way they find is to just let go and say that, okay, this is my view, but we will follow your view. And then that's how the cooperation works. So basically what Prabhupada wanted the society to flourish by cooperation. That's why he kept repeating this so often right till the end, that you can show your love for me by how you cooperate. Because without that, cooperation is the essence of any movement. You may have the purities there in the shastras coming down from disciplic succession, and then we're training devotees. But then when we preach and we spread, and then you need an organization, you need interaction with so many people, how do they get along? So this is the, and many times we have different views. And different views doesn't mean that you are enemies. Different views that means is that you are intelligent people who have come from, who have a different approach to how to go about it. And then you can't have a stalemate, you have to go forward. So this is the way, and if they show us at the highest levels, then what to speak of in within one temple or within one society, one smaller group or one department. This is what we learn, that you may, you know, we may try to justify a certain approach and then find that there are different views and very strongly held views. So then someone has to give in. So so if we don't have that ultimate desire to please our superiors or our Guru Maharaj or Lord Krishna, Prabhupada, by taking on the cooperation. But if you are concerned by seeing that what I am saying should prevail, then that means we are again putting our own self first. So this attachment to our own view would have to be pushed back. So Prabhupada said this so many times, you know, saying that when he talked about cooperation, he said actually he was so humble that he said, you are actually the ones who are doing everything. I am getting the credit, but you are doing everything because you are cooperating with me. But we know that it was his magnetic personality and his purity which attracted devotees. But the fact is that devotees came with such different backgrounds and a non-Krishna conscious upbringing. But when they came there, they also made so many sacrifices. So difficult, you know, to just swallow your pride and do what you do. So to, you know, when we feel competitive, when we feel that I can do better than someone else, why is he getting the credit? He has not done this. Sometimes somebody else gets the praise. So, and then you feel that you have done it. But then we forget that sometimes we have not done and we get the credit when we have not done also. So it works both ways. So at that time, to let go and to, in the overall spirit of the movement, is very difficult. But if it is done, then it lays the foundation for, you know, others to follow. And especially those who are in leadership positions have to do that. And if you see other examples in Shastra also where this attachment to their own self is so strong, or to the what they want, to their sense gratification, and then therefore any opposition to it is a threat. Duryodhan is another classic example where because he was so strongly wanting to control everything himself that he was not satisfied even after the Pandavas were unfairly defeated in the gambling match and then they were sent off to exile. Even then Duryodhan was in great anxiety because he was then thinking that what happens after 13 years when they'll come back and then they'll do this. So even though he had made so many attempts to kill them earlier, he kept making attempts to find out where they were and to see that how they would go back for another 13 years or to be killed. So this stems from the fact that you cannot find peace and happiness, contentment, even if you do get what you want, if you are not actually satisfying the Lord. So if we have a material position, if we have attraction for a material prestige, then perhaps we will get some satisfaction. But that satisfaction will be tinged with some frustration, envy, some anger, or some anxiety. But if we really want the satisfaction of the heart, it is when we do for others on a completely selfless basis, when we have no motives. If there is no ulterior motive in what we are doing, then there is a contentment with whatever little we may be doing. And that because then the devotee is not looking for recognition. The devotee is only desirous to see that he does the task in that consciousness to please whoever he is doing the task for. So ultimately, Krishna is not looking at what we do. He is looking at the humility of our consciousness, of in which we do this. So that the consciousness in which we do is so important. And if we take a softer or a more or a humble attitude, so we have to work towards this. So along with our spiritual practices, if we do not see this being gradually brought into our lives, then actually, we will find other ways that we, with our ability to perhaps give classes, we do so many other things for the services, we will then develop pride, feeling that I have done this or I can do this, and slowly forgetting that everything has been given by Krishna, even the intelligence has been given by Krishna. And then in this pursuit, we should also be very careful that there may be many disguises in which Maya may come to tempt us or to derail us, to distract us. And it can also come through our close relatives, could be through our parents, perhaps maybe through our spouse, could be through our very close friend, in a disguise form, and we may not recognize it. So, therefore, we have to ultimately, while we cooperate with everyone, but our responsibility to Krishna is as a living entity, we have to see that we discharge it, because ultimately we are all strangers, in the sense that all living entities have come through millions of lives, and we come together only for this particular life. But because we think that this span of 50, 70, 80 years is the only, because that's the only visible thing, they're looking through our gross senses, therefore we cannot, we don't have the perception of what it is like, of how many thousands of lives we may have gone through. We may even speak it out, but we cannot imagine what it is like. And we don't know what it is like to go into other lives, to other living entities. We may even say that, okay, we'll fall into a bird category or animal category. We may say it, but we can't imagine what it is like to be an insect or a lizard or an animal or a leper on the street or someone who's really, really suffering. So because of that, we see that what we do in this life is enough, and that's why we don't need to do more than that. So in this connection, about the, there's again a story in a Krishna book about a demon who came as disguised as a close friend, which is also a learning lesson for us. His name was Vyomasur, and when Krishna, among many past time, many games that they played with his friends, they were playing one day, and they were playing a game where they had three groups. So there were some who were playing as lambs, some who were playing as thieves, and some who were playing as police constables. And ultimately, the nature of Krishna's games with his friends was that he would be wanting to do anything to please his friends. And cowherd friends' nature was to see that they would please Krishna, whatever it takes. So if Krishna would achieve that by losing, he would lose, you know, whether any wrestling match or any game that they played. But if he achieved by that aim of pleasing his friends by winning, then he would win. So basically his aim was to please his friends, and his friends, that is the cowherd boys, only goal was to please Krishna. So the whole mood was that. It was not who ultimately won that particular game. So when they were playing this, so Krishna was had the role of a police constable. So the Vyomasur, with his mystic powers, he came and then he disguised himself as a cowherd boy, exactly like a cowherd boy, in such a way that all the others felt that he's just one of them. And he took on the role of a thief. And as a thief, he started stealing, or taking away all the boys, one by one. So initially, it was part of a game that generally you tap someone, he says, you are out. So then that person is out. So in the game, to see that the boys were becoming less in number was normal. But what he was doing is he was taking those boys and transporting them in a moment to a cave nearby. It is somewhere outside Kamyavan. So he was putting them in a deep, dark cave and blocking that with a big rock. And over time, most of the boys were put, the cowherd boys were locked up there. And then Krishna eventually then noticed that suddenly the number of people have shrunk. Where have they gone? So of course, at the appropriate time when he felt it necessary, he confronted Vyomasur. So what is told to us in the story and the understanding is that the, first of all, the boys were, wherever they were in a deep dark cave, is because they trusted the wrong person. They put their faith, they put their trust in a person who was cheating them. So that means there is a responsibility on us to also know whom we put our trust in. We can't say that I was innocent, because we have, in most cases we can't say that. There may be some exceptions, but in most cases a person is given the intelligence, he knows the process, even as a devotee, to know who is cheating him. So it is important that we also, and even in Krishna consciousness, we have the process of understanding the scriptures, then examining against the previous sadhus and acharyas' lives, and the present gurus also instructing, and therefore we hear that if everything is consistent, then we accept it with complete faith. So it is faith based on reason. So therefore, it is said that they were locked in that because they trusted the wrong people and wrong demon. The demon. So they were, then Krishna released them. But then when Krishna confronted Vyomasur was very afraid. And he felt that, because he knew he was caught. So now see his reaction also. His first reaction was to run away. But he started running, and then Krishna grabbed him very hard and held him back. Then he tried to make himself bigger, because he had the powers to grow and grow. He thought he'll grow out of Krishna's hand. So he made himself much bigger. But then Krishna saw to it, and then he kept the grip, and then eventually killed him. So what we are told is that, it is the nature of our mind is also like that. That when we get exposed, just like Vyomasur got caught by Krishna. So here, when we are caught or exposed, we first try to run away. We will not surrender. Like Vyomasur did not surrender to Krishna. He tried to rebel and fight back. So we also do the same thing. And it is said that Vyomasur was wanting to grow bigger, when he knew he was exposed and threatened, the same way we also take a view of what is the meaning of exposure of the mind? Like when we are exposed, meaning if someone, if our ego is seen through by someone, some devotee or some well-wisher, and he comes and tells that, you are in Maya, or and we get upset, and we said, no, you have a misunderstanding, or it's not like this. We want to justify that there's a miscommunication. You haven't really understood. So we argue back and we fight. We don't take it easily. We don't accept the person, the point of view. So this is something like rebelling against and not accepting. When we are completely exposed, when we've done something wrong. So this is also an example of how we can be tricked. So if we have strong attachments, then the question of envy comes. Because if you have something, the more you have, the more you are afraid to lose it. If you have nothing, then you don't worry about, there's nothing to lose. So whether it is in prestige, whether it is in power or money, whether it's in knowledge or looks, physical beauty, so many ways, whatever attributes we have, if the more we have, there is a risk that that it could be a curse on us rather than benediction. But in the material world, because we do not look at the material consciousness, we do not look at this, we don't even acknowledge that. Therefore, we consider it that this is what we want to pursue. And we want to increase based on our attribute, the grossness, the connection to our body becomes even more. So, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's example that these four attributes are like the... It's a golden crown, which is attractive. All these attributes of looks and wealth, lineage, and power, knowledge. But it's like when it's put on a drowning person, somebody is drowning in the ocean and then you put that 10 kg crown, then actually you are hastening his doom faster. So it's like that, that because we are in this ocean of and we are groping for coming out of it, and this ocean is representing all the darkness of all our frailties, our weaknesses, the unearthers that we have. So when we are trying to come out, and then the weight is, this adds to the weight, because it becomes that much more difficult. If you've got a lot of money, it becomes very, very difficult not to be attached to it. Because you're all the time thinking how to use it, and then how others should not take it, and how to increase it. And then if someone else has more, then you want to increase that more. So your concern then gets diverted to thinking, what should I do to counter that? Leaving aside the fact that you have more than enough. So the whole attention shifts. Same with all the other attributes. Same if you've been given, you're blessed with a great amount of strength. You are concerned if someone else is getting stronger. So that is where the dangers happen. So the formula that we have been given is that we have to seek contentment. We should be content with what we have. And we cannot be contented unless we see everything belonging to Krishna and seeing that we have our own role. And everything is given by Krishna so that whatever is in store for us, we will get. If we have an unexpected, so-called unexpected, attribute given to us, or for instance, if I suddenly find that an aunt has given some tens of lakhs of rupees left, it was unexpected and it comes to in your kitty. Oh, then if the consciousness is right, then you say, well, Krishna has arranged it. I will do what I can do. So you apart from emergencies and personal needs, you'll acknowledge and thank Krishna. So anything that comes in our way, if it comes in abundance, we know it is coming from Krishna. If it is taken away or is not given, it is the Krishna's will. So it has been designed according to, first of all, our karma, and also according to, as a devotee, if you want to come closer to Krishna, Krishna will judge the process and say that it's perfectly customized for this devotee, that for him, this is the best way. It is best that he stumbles. It is best that he has these calamities, or it's best that, or best that he let him use. Like in Prabhupada's case, he was given unbelievable success. In 12 years, even by corporate standards, if you say in 12 years, you go from zero to 108 temples. If you put it in terms of value in millions of dollars, even by those standards, it was just unbelievable. But because Prabhupada never saw it that way, he got so much. So it was incidental. We see from his prayers when he went to the, he was only wanting to bring Krishna consciousness to the people of the world. That was his mood in the beginning, and that was the mood in the end. That didn't change. What comes and goes, that is because he knew that everything is happening from Krishna. So that mood is what can protect us from this danger of envy, which can otherwise even creep into a devotee's life. So we should know that a devotee does not, at any stage, cannot avoid unless he is very aware. He cannot avoid the falling into the pitfall unless he is very, very aware of it and takes corrective action. It is not that beyond a certain stage, the door to envy is closed and we are completely safe. It is never. In fact, because it's Krishna's, Maya's duty to follow Krishna's instructions to test us. So in fact, if we actually have been very enthusiastic in following the spiritual practices and devotional service and wanting to do more, then you will be sure that there will be tests which are unexpected and which we may... So if you are very much vigilant, and the vigilance is again how only by letting other people connect to us, by taking their example, by also wanting to sincerely follow the process of chanting our rounds every day, hearing the philosophy. Hearing is the key process. Applying it and being anxious to improve. If that anxiety to improve is not there, then it's very difficult to let someone come in, into our life. And without that, we will not have any, we find it very difficult to accept someone corrects us. So we'll stop here. If there's any questions.
Hare Krishna. We do so many services, and when we don't do it, nothing happens, but we have to do, sometimes proactively do services. So first question is, how to do so much service and still think that I am not the doer?
Take one at a time. So, if whatever service we are doing, it's really the consciousness in which we are doing the service. It's not that if we do one service, we are less than if somebody who does five services. It is not, again, the quantum of service. It's the quality of consciousness. So someone may be doing seven things, someone may be doing only one thing. Someone may be spending, we have heard examples in the movement, somebody who has spent 35 years just doing a very menial, you know, cleaning the pot or cleaning, just doing some simple service. Or just taking care of the child at home, 35 years. It's as good a service than someone who may be doing, juggling with five things, because the capacity Krishna may have given, how much a person can do. But the faithfulness and the quality of consciousness is in our hands. So first of all, the quantity of service is not relevant. And secondly, in the consciousness, if we had, what is our purpose of doing the service? If the purpose is to please genuinely please, then the immediate superior, the temple president or the guru or whoever has given us the service and thereby please Prabhupada and Krishna, then we would be most anxious to, as I mentioned, that it is the Krishna is not looking at the end result, the output. He is looking at the humility of our consciousness. So we would be most concerned with how we do the service, and then we would be concerned with how efficiently we can do it. So if our concern is, focus is on that, then we would be well protected by, because pleasing the superiors would also mean that if we are not doing it in the right spirit, we will be corrected. Like Maharaj, for instance, he has laid the foundation here by constantly stressing this, and he has his own ways of straightening things, or correcting, or bringing up, when he feels that someone is, perhaps he may move the service away, or may just, people who know, have spent time with him, they immediately know that whether he's happy or not happy. You can sense that you may have done, there's tremendous success, you may have collected 50 lakhs, or donated a big amount. But if the consciousness is not right, if you are vigilant for it, if you are vigilant and you are following that whether the person is genuinely pleased with it or not. So, but then if you are consumed by just the quantity or the output of the service, then that will become number one in our mind, and then we will not be so not looking between the lines, not looking at. Are we actually in the right spirit? Because if we are in doubt, we can always ask. We would also get the confirmation from various ways, either directly or indirectly. And when people may come up and talk to us and encourage us, and we can sense. And then people whose values count, particularly those who are there for a long time and who are a guide. So it's basically what becomes most important. So if it's most important in how we do it, rather than what we do, then perhaps you would be protected. And secondly, the one service or whatever service we do, it is not the it's not the size or the visibility. Some service may, by definition, may be putting us in prominence. Somebody is has to take the responsibility. It's like, let's say, in the temple management, somebody has to take up the responsibility of taking decisions and as a president. But if you start looking and saying that, oh, he's the president, so he's the best, and he's just a junior person because he's cleaning the toilet, then that person who's seeing that is obviously missed the point. The point is that there's, in Krishna's eyes, in everyone's eyes, they're all equal. Services are all equal. In fact, but if the consciousness of the person who's sweeping the floor is better, then he is actually a much more advanced devotee than a person who may be doing higher services but thinking that I'm getting things done and I have got the... even though he may not say it out loud, but if that is his thinking. So that's why it's a good question, because we have to be... We can never be sure, but we have to be very vigilant. And if it's a burning anxiety, if it's really worrying us all the time, and it should, then we will always be looking for seeing that, am I doing it in the right way? Am I displeasing someone? Have I spoken something out of turn? Because if we don't, then nobody's going to tell us in most cases. So it's really up to us to show that if it is a real concern, then our concern would be to just be in total anxiety about it, in fact. When we do any service, then we're doing it properly. Not that in the beginning, first year, we may do it in a very humble state. After 10 years, we just feel that, no, I am a senior, and then I'm from sub-junior, I've gone to junior, now I've become senior. Even in devotee circles, we do feel that someone is 25 years, he's very senior. It's good for the person, the young, newer people to feel that. It is their mood. But it's not the right mood for the person who's there for 25 years. He has experience, but if he thinks that I am senior, so it's basically the consciousness. Second question.
Hare Krishna. Second question is, you were talking about having no ulterior motives. So we are all influenced by three modes. Major our mode of passion, mode of ignorance. So how to really apply this principle, even though when we are not on higher purity platform, how to have no ulterior motive, when we are mixed. What we do, there is like the higher standard is to do everything only for pleasing Krishna. So we are not on that platform of purity. So what we do, I just want to know the practical.
Again, the motive means what is our desire. If the desire is too mixed, like we want, there is a spiritual benefit, but there's also something. The ulterior meaning, it is not apparent, but it is really the main motive. But there may be a motive which is an obvious one, but in our mind there is another motive which is actually hidden, which is even more crucial. For instance, same example, that if someone is doing deity worship, so the motive is, of course, I want to do service and I'm trained for it, I've given an exam, I can do it. But if there is an ulterior motive that, there are 1,000 people seeing or 100 people are there and I would like to, I'm right up there, and, that could be an ulterior motive. So, again, the guarding against, we can answer it ourselves, actually, if we are vigilant and questioning that what is really, because we know what is really in the heart of us. Krishna knows and we know that when we're doing it, what is really the purpose that we're doing? Ulterior motives is something which as this is my understanding, that we would eventually, if we question ourselves, we will know. If you're looking for it, we will know what is it that makes it. It may be subconscious, it may be instinctive, but we really know what is moving, what is our desire. Because if we're actually acting on our desire, that means we are aware of what our desire is. So again, I think the same that we have to question it, always evaluate it. Why am I doing this? This question that Maharaj put, that are we, feeding the devotees or feeding the Lord, or are we feeding our false ego? So false ego comes in so many ways. So this ulterior motive is something which may not be seen by others, but we would know. And as an example, I'm just saying that, Kirtida Mataji is always translating. It's a very difficult service, but, because the desire is to help. So, and that is her desire. But if somebody's desire is also that he sees that, there are so many people and they're watching, they know that one person is actually translating for so many people. Most people may not be aware, but if the person is doing it, if he has a motive, then he knows what his motive is. Yes. I just gave that example, Mataji, so don't. In case you're replying to that. My question is on that.
Hare Krishna. Prabhuji, thank you for a wonderful lecture. And the doubt that comes to my mind is that you said about the motive behind any action. Like anybody is doing any particular seva or is giving a lecture, then we know that people who conduct these meditation classes, they just say that you keep your mind still, let the thoughts come and let them go. You just keep watching the thoughts and let them go. But in case of devotees, these thoughts do come. Even if we keep pushing them back, they do keep coming. Like the thought may come, oh, you are a better devotee than this person. You speak better than this person. You are very humble. The mind keeps telling us that at that stage, we don't want those thoughts. So are we still accountable for those thoughts? And the second question also I have, how can Prithu Maharaj's son, even if he was capable, how could he kill Indra? Indra is not a human, so can he be killed? That doubt came in my mind.
I think second question probably Radha Gopinath will answer. I presume what I read is that he could have killed him, but he didn't. But in the first one, Krishna sees the struggle in everything that we do. Like we are told that when we are chanting also, that why the effort should concentrate is uppermost. Hardly anyone will be able to put up his hand and say that for the entire 2 hours he is completely focused only on Krishna. It's very difficult. But then we are constantly also told that Krishna only sees the struggle. He wants to see that example of that spider and Hanuman. Whatever capacity we have, so even if we fall down or if we have deviated, the effort to rest it back. So here also when we are struggling with our own weaknesses and the thoughts come, then how much of an effort we are making. So the first step in the effort is to recognize that we have a problem. So therefore, devotee when he or she does feel that, we are very worried about it. We don't need to get depressed because, not that we are a perfect or pure devotee and but we do worry about it and we are concerned about it. That's the first step. Then what do we do about it? And then to do that is that we constantly struggle. We are associating with the right people. When we associate with people who are so much more qualified spiritually, and yet they just they brush off any kind of recognition or these thoughts. You can see it is, they're not even aware of their own value. So then being near them, hearing them, actually gives us, internally the strength also, and it rubs off on us a little bit. So the process is that we keep struggling, but then we have to take that step. So how do we say that we're struggling? The struggle means that whatever steps we take, it is not for others. It is basically for Krishna to ultimately see and judge that whether we are doing it. So I mean, this is a problem with for all, but first to recognize that we do have a problem, and second, we make as much strength as possible to avoid that, to fight that rather.
Thank you. Pass the mic.
Lieutenant Prabhu.
Hare Krishna. Thank you for this class.
You like to answer that second part? I don't know.
Okay.
Adha Gopinath Prabhu said after class he will tell you later.
Prabhuji, you spoke about even the devotees also has to be aware of this problem of envy. I have one practical doubt that, as you mentioned, in the same field, if somebody is excelling and they are being glorified in front of you, and naturally the devotees, they see you, that how you are reacting. And you have a pressure also. At the same time, you are also aware that you are not completely happy because we are not pure devotees. So you are also struggling to accept that. So at that situation, in the practical situation, we can also glorify this other person like others. But also we also feel that I'm not actually doing from my heart. So in such kind of practical vocations, what should we do actually? Like, should we, if we glorify, we feel we are doing artificially, or should we, if we don't do, and others will feel he is really envious. And kind of, you know, it's a big kind of a trauma. I'm sorry. It is in my level, I'm asking. So, what is your suggestion?
I go through it also. So, I would say the best thing is that, in any case, we are struggling with the feeling of not being completely happy because we have felt that somebody else has done. That's instinctively it comes. It's better to at least, if we can, then we should actually speak out. Even though we know, and we may be disgusted with ourselves, saying that I said it, but I don't feel it. But then that's a step which will at least make us introspect more and think, rather than not doing anything about it. So that struggle starts from there. That and you know that you're not doing it to be treacherous to someone. It's that you want to reach that stage, that you want to match your words with your own heart. At least take the first step, and then it's another thing if someone is doing it to motive to, you know, be diplomatic and get something out. That is, of course, very bad. But here we may see that we are actually echoing something which, that way we echo so many things. We may say so many things in class and, you know, we prepare for it. So in the same way here, at least saying it out would put that issue in a, you know, limelight for us. You know, and then we'll be grappling with it later also, angry with ourselves and saying, and then knowing that, you know, obviously I still have this weakness, I still feel that. But if we don't have that, then we are not likely to, you know, do whatever is necessary in future to minimize it. So bringing it out and making it painful to us is Krishna's way also of helping us to, he's giving us a tip, because then, in which case, we will be more encouraged to take some steps to correct it. Radha Gopinath Prabhu would like to. And so we'll end here. Granth Raj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.